The question often asked in discussions of immigration is why? Why do people leave their home countries and come to the United States, whether their entry is legal or not? A better life is the generic answer often given, but better than what? The answer for the people you'll hear about this hour is better than dying in gang violence, potentially. Twin boys from El Salvador are the focus of Lauren Markham's book, The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Lauren Markham lives in Berkeley and writes about youth, migration, the environment, and other issues. Her work appears in the likes of Vice and Orion and The New Yorker Online. She's also spent time working in refugee resettlement and immigrant education. Lauren Markham, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
So you don't just write about the issue, you live in it. What is it that you do or did at Oakland International High School?
Yeah, I still work there. I'm what's called a community school manager. So I'm essentially, so Oakland International High School is a school for 100% newly arrived immigrant youth. And my role is to coordinate services and programs to kind of meet the socio-emotional needs of students, so the wraparound services that support them to be more successful in the classroom. So that includes mental health, access to health services, access to legal services. You know, it's hard to focus on your math class or your science class if you have an abscess tooth or if you're in deportation proceedings and you don't have a lawyer.
Wow, so this is a whole bunch of areas you can get into in a given day with a given person.
Oh, yes. No day is the same. It's very exciting.
Truly. Do you remember becoming aware of the phrase unaccompanied minor and what it meant and what it means?
Yeah, I do. So I actually started reporting. So I work at a school for immigrant youth in the Oakland School District, and I've done that for about a decade, working in refugee resettlement and immigrant education, as you mentioned. But I'm also a writer and a reporter. And so toward the end of 2012, I actually got an assignment and started reporting on unaccompanied minors, and that took me to South Texas, where they're most often apprehended and detained. And so I was writing about it at the end of 2012. The story was published in a magazine called VQR in 2013. Then I had more questions. I wrote another article for Vice magazine. And just when that was going to press in 2014, all of a sudden a teacher, and I chronicle this in my new book, but a teacher came into my office and said, you know, we really need to do something about all of these young people in our school who have upcoming court dates. And I was sort of like, wait, what? So all of a sudden I'd been reporting about unaccompanied minors outside of the school and all around the country. And because the numbers were just kind of spiraling out of control, they ended up coming to my school and were sort of had been for several months right under my nose without me knowing. So it was this kind of convergence of my writing and reporting life and the work at the school.
So where do unaccompanied minors usually come from, and why are they unaccompanied?
Yeah, so the vast majority of them, I think around 95%, are coming from the Northern Triangle of Central America, which is a region comprised of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And they're coming for a complex stew of reasons, and every person has sort of a different, everyone is different, right? But the main reasons that they're coming are for family reunification, for economic reasons, right, because there's limited economic opportunity in these countries. But increasingly, they're coming because of the rampant gang violence that is overtaking the Northern Triangle. So when we think of the economic reasons or family reunification, for example, I live in Honduras, my mom moved from Honduras and lives in the United States, or my dad or my older brother, or economic reasons, you know, I need money to support myself or for my family, or I want better opportunity. Those are what we think of as pull factors, things that pull young people to the United States. But increasingly, we're seeing that there are actually push factors, things pushing people out of their country. So they're not just trying to come to the United States. What they're actually trying to do is leave their homes for safety.
Which makes you wonder about the parents who they leave behind. I mean, if there are parents behind them in the Northern Triangle, are they essentially sacrificing themselves for the good of their kids?
Absolutely. The other issue is that the main, you know, just imagine, I'm not a parent, but, and so I can only imagine what it's like to sort of send your kids on this harrowing journey to the north with sort of very uncertain circumstances and with kind of a total lack of clarity of what will happen to them along the way. But this feeling that, you know, the risk that they're taking on this harrowing journey is better than the risk of living in their hometowns and in their home country. But, you know, it used to be that it was the adults who were going and leaving their children behind. That was much more common in the 90s and even the early 2000s and way back when, that the adults would go send money back to support their children. And the reason that more youth are going north now as opposed to the parents is because youth are really the victims and the main victims and casualties of this gang violence. Youth are predominantly the kind of foot soldiers that make up the gangs in Central America. They're targeted for recruitment. They're also, young people are the majority of people who are killed in the gang violence. So it's really a war against youth in a way.
Yeah, I remember from when the stories seemed to be so big in the news a few years ago that that these were not all teenagers. How young are some of the people who are coming unaccompanied?
Oh, I mean, tiny toddlers. I've been to court. So these young people, if they're apprehended in the U.S. by immigration authorities, they're placed into deportation proceedings. And because it's immigration court, they're not provided attorneys. So I've seen kids as young as 6, 5 go in front of a judge without a lawyer. And they've crossed without parents into the United States.
Wow. So you ended up following the Flores brothers who were, and yes, the names have been changed to guard their identities. Why them? How old were they?
They were 17 when they crossed into the United States. They were sort of just turned 17 when they left their home countries. And I chose them because for a number of reasons. They actually didn't have the most harrowing story that I've heard, and far from it. But what was really compelling to me about them, they're identical twin brothers. One of them got on the wrong side of kind of a local bad guy and ends up having to leave pretty quickly because he fears for his life. I think very rightfully fears for his life. He leaves El Salvador, and then within a week or two, his younger brother, the family realizes that the younger brother, and by younger I mean 12 minutes younger, they realize that he's also at risk because he looks exactly like his twin. So if they're trying to kill one of them, they're you know, this second brother could be mistaken.
All right. Yeah, that's where the you're looking like your twin does not help you at all. So
no.
Many more details to get into in the book, The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Lauren Markham, got to know them fairly well and put a lot of mileage in reporting the story as well for the book. We'll talk more about Lauren's travels and the things she found out about the brothers when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lauren Markham, who lives in Berkeley and writes about youth, migration, the environment, and many other issues. She also works at the Oakland International High School, which is a 100% student body of people who newly arrived in the United States. She's written a book about twin brothers who left El Salvador and came to the United States to escape gang violence. It's called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we go through this. 800-838-8 let's try this again. 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to be clear, this is a very long process of reporting and writing this book. So when did you begin the research, and was it not tied to any electoral campaigns or anything?
No, absolutely. It was not tied to any electoral campaigns. Well, I began reporting on unaccompanied minors in 2012. So these were my first reporting before I even had a notion of the book. That did contribute mightily to the book. So I would say that I've been working on it since the end of 2012, so about 5 years. But in earnest, the book deal was accepted in mid 2015, and I finished it about 2 years later. So writing it in earnest was about 2 years.
There's a very effective contrast, Lauren, in the beginning of the book, where you contrast the extreme difficulty in finding the federal courthouse in San Francisco for a hearing with El Salvador, where the Flores in quotes brothers came from. Let's get an idea of just how violent their part of El Salvador is.
Yeah, it is. It's such a tremendous country and such a beautiful and remarkable place that has been racked by war and violence, and unfortunately is in the throes of a pretty unconventional war right now. It's about 3% of El Salvador's GDP goes to extortion rings, which are run by the gangs. So about 3% of the GDP, if you can imagine, is controlled and sort of recouped by gangs. Prisons are currently at 310% of the capacity, so you have people crammed into these prison cells. Only about 95% of crimes in the Northern Triangle go charged, and it has one of the highest murder rates in the world.
Well, it sounds like if it's this big a part of the GDP, there's probably money to throw around to pay off people in the law enforcement business. But let me ask you anyway, who could or would stop the crimes, and why don't they?
Well, I think that they are trying, and they're trying valiantly in their own way. But I think that when violence spirals out of control and is really endemic, and you have a kind of socio-political and economic context in which there are limited opportunities, the gangs are really filling a vacuum. They're filling an economic vacuum. More than 300,000 youth in El Salvador, and remember, this is a country of only 6.6 million people, more than 300,000 youth are out of school and without a job. So you have this sort of lack of opportunity that the gangs fill. The police have been cracking down in a series of Iron Fist or Mano Dura campaigns. However, it's really this police intervention, this kind of like crackdown, that is only kind of creating a violence arms race that's serving to increase violence. So in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of many people, it's really, you know, stopping the violence at this point is an issue of creating social alternatives so that people who would be susceptible to either being forced into a gang or joining a gang because of force of circumstances of their lives would have another opportunity and something else that they could do.
I probably want to start with the 300,000 people who have no school and no job. Why are so many people let loose?
Well, so these are young people, and I think it's something like between the ages of 16 and 25, I think, is the range. Look, only a half of Salvadoran youth enroll in 7th to 9th grade, so you have people dropping out because the schooling is limited and because they need to work. At the same time, there are limited jobs, so people are working in informal economies and unable to kind of like find the full-time jobs that it would allow them to sustain themselves or kind of have any upward mobility. Also, schools are overcrowded in El Salvador, which is really a euphemism for they're underfunded. So kids only go to school half day in El Salvador. You either go in the morning or you go in the afternoon.
Wow. So a lot of circumstances here that led these two young men to leave El Salvador and head for the United States. The book is called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Lauren Markham, the author and our guest on The Exchange. So what did Ernesto and Raul, again, not their real names, do to run afoul of gangs?
Well, it's sort of a complex story, but essentially they had a family member who ran a human smuggling business, and because he was sort of higher profile, he was protected by the gangs. And they essentially got into like a pretty low level that became a very high level family feud. And in certain places, life can be cheap. And so this man was really frustrated with one of them and essentially put a price tag on his head.
So, give us a little backstory here. How long have the gangs and the violence been there? I mean, do the young men's parents remember better times?
Yeah, the young men's parents do remember better times, but at the same time, they also remember the Civil War. So in the 80s, there was a terribly wretched Civil War and a series of them actually throughout Central America that the United States was involved in. There were rightist governments controlled by the oligarchies in these countries, and I'll speak specifically about El Salvador. There are, you know, about a dozen families in El Salvador that are kind of the landed oligarchic families that had a very friendly to them government, and it was one of those situations where about 90% of the wealth was controlled by the top 10% or even less of the people, a trend that unfortunately the United States is moving closer and closer toward itself. And so the government was both controlled by the oligarchs and it was a very heavy-handed military regime. There was a leftist uprising that the United States had a vested interest in helping squash because it was during the kind of end times of the Cold War when the idea of communism or socialism coming so close to our borders was terrifying to us. And so we funded these rightist governments that wreaked total havoc on the country and just tried to stamp out the guerrilla forces by essentially terrorizing the villages where they suspected, with no real good reason, that the guerrillas were hiding out or coming from. So there are several massacres, one of which I talk a little bit about in my book, where the government would come in and perpetuate these scorched earth campaigns, the government of El Salvador, using guns and training and money from the United States. So that meant that hundreds of thousands of people left El Salvador, came to the United States, some with papers, some not with papers. And it was actually in the United States that the current gangs that are wreaking havoc in El Salvador were born, particularly MS-13. It was born in Los Angeles among traumatized, disenfranchised young people who had fled the civil war in El Salvador. They were then deported back to El Salvador, where they essentially imported the gangs, and the gangs began to take hold.
Let me make sure we follow this again. So these are people who had left the violence in El Salvador, had moved to the United States, formed the gang MS-13 in the United States, were then deported. And so essentially the United States exported this gang MS-13 into El Salvador.
Yes.
Wow.
You got it. Very good summary.
So the twins' brother, the twins of the main characters and the faraway mm-hmm. brothers, you call him Wilbur Jr., again, not a real name, wanted out. What did he do?
He left about 7 years before the twins did, so in the 90s, and he wanted out for economic reasons, although also because, you know, the violence was starting to ramp up too. I'm sorry, he didn't leave in the 90s. He left in the mid-2000s, and he left. He got a coyote, got smuggled into the United States, and also as a 17-year-old, and he was not caught, unlike his twin brothers who come 7 years later. He was not caught. He was put. He made it to Oakland, where he's been living. To California, where he's been living undocumented for the past, I guess now it's like 9 years.
So he'd already gotten out of El Salvador. Mm-hmm. The twins were left behind with, and they have a whole bunch of other siblings, don't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
How big a family?
The family is 11 altogether, so 9 kids and 2 parents.
Wow. It's not a real wealthy life for sure.
No.
The twins did have their own issues with other kids in school and around town, as you describe in the book. What kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, the gang violence was sort of growing in their town, and their town has, comparatively to some of the like really gang hotspots in El Salvador, is not by any means the worst of the worst when it comes to gang violence. But young people were increasingly joining the gangs in and around the town, and were putting pressure on them to join as well.
So did the gang life appeal to them on any level?
I think probably. They say that they had no interest in joining the gang, but I think that there's some idea that a gang will give you money and will give you sort of status and will give you some kind of like clout, which for very poor young men who are struggling could be an appealing thing. That's true for, I think, a lot of young people everywhere, right? You're seeking belonging, you're seeking some kind of upward mobility, you're seeking financial stability and status. So I think it probably did appeal to them to some degree, but they're also terrified of it and didn't want to take any part. It's of note that there's some mythology, both I think in our consciousness here in the United States and in El Salvador as well, that the gang life is some sort of like, you know, highfalutin kind of dark, glamorous lifestyle. But the fact is that most gang members are barely surviving themselves and are simply, you know, they have their phones paid for, they have some food, and they maybe have a place to stay. But it's not like most gang members, even on the top, are not getting wealthy off of this. It's really a survival game.
That's what I was about to say. It's more of a level of protection, or at least just getting through day to day.
Exactly.
Lauren Markham is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's written a book about twin brothers who got out of El Salvador and got into the United States and all the reasons and all the pathways along there. The book is called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Before the twins had run afoul of a gang, before the older by 12 minutes had run afoul of gang life there, had either of them really considered El Norte, this idea of getting out and going north?
One of them had, because there was this, you know, it's a large family, a very poor family. They're mostly subsistence farmers. When the older brother left, he sort of promised to help the family, and he did to some extent, but then he sort of fell off the radar. And, you know, I think when a lot of migrants come to the United States, they have this idea that, oh my gosh, you can make $12 an hour there, you know, I'll send money home. But the fact is, especially in California, life is quite expensive. So the older of the twins, again, older by 12 minutes, had some sort of fantasies of going to the north. The younger one, the second twin, really didn't. He had no interest. He wanted to stay in El Salvador. They both, though, sort of, it ended up not really being a choice that they had to leave kind of regardless.
So how fast did things go once they made the decision for the older twin to get out?
Within a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. There were some delays. He was going to go very quickly, and then there were some delays that had him kind of hiding out for a while, fearful for his life, and then he was on the road.
Well, you mentioned subsistence farming, so not a family with a lot of means here. How expensive can it be to hire a coyote to lead the way north?
Great question. The running rate is $7,000 to $8,000 from Central America, and that generally gives you three tries. So you have three tries if you're deported or you somehow just don't make it. They'll give you three tries. I have heard, although this was, I will say, about a year and a half ago, but I was hearing from immigration authorities that there was a new rate given the kind of increasing border patrol presence and just kind of attention on immigration issues, that it was they were offering like a $10,000 to $12,000 rate that was a lifetime guarantee, where basically you could try as many times until you either gave up, died, or made it.
Well, so where did they come up with the money? I mean, we're talking about, by comparison with the United States, where a recent poll showed that about half the households in the country don't have enough money on hand for a major emergency, and yep. this would be a major, major emergency.
Absolutely. So what happens is very few people have this kind of money lying around. I don't have this kind of money lying around that I could just pay cash overnight. And, there's a whole kind of shadow industry of unregulated, very high interest loans from community members. So people in this circumstance take out these loans. When I asked the father what the interest rate was for this loan, he said, "Oh, it's 5%. No, it's 50%." And he's an incredibly smart man, an incredibly devoted father. He's like, an expert farmer, but he has a second grade education, and so his math math understanding is very limited. So he signed up for this loan with very little understanding of the interest rates, and it kind of didn't matter in the sense that they were going to do it anyway, and that's what these lenders are profiting off of. They're profiting off of the desperation of having to move people out quickly. So within 6 months of having left, it was $7,000 a person for the twins. It was over $20,000 with the compounding interest.
Wow,
that
is a lot of money.
All
right, so money aside, I mean, what did the road ahead look like when the older twin was trying to get out of town? I mean, what sorts of complications did they expect to encounter, because they had to go through Mexico and then into the United States?
Yeah, through Guatemala and then Mexico and the United States. It's in the best of circumstances, it's a harrowing journey. People are routinely robbed, they're assaulted, there's sexual assault is really common. Migrants are known to be carrying cash, and so they've become an increasing target for just robber profiteers, but also for the cartels. As the drug trade has shifted in and around the border, cartels actually now have a business of kidnapping people and then extorting their families in the United States or sometimes back home in whatever country they're coming from for money. So it's a very, very, very harrowing journey. And the twins, don't want to give too much away, but they each experienced their own deeply traumatic event along the road.
So where were the twins reunited? You mentioned that the older brother, older by 12 minutes again, left earlier, and then his brother made the decision to follow him about a week later.
Yes. So they actually met up in kind of the outskirts of Mexico City in the home of their human smuggler, who brought the older twin to Mexico City, then went back, kind of unbeknownst to the older twin, actually went back, picked up the younger twin, and brought him there where they reunited, and then they went north together.
Give me a sense of the business of people who do help smuggle them out, the coyotes, because we hear lots of stories about people getting ripped off by them, but it sounds like this is become something of a real reputable profession.
Yeah, and I actually think that, it's really hard to know, but from their perspective, their coyote, who was actually a woman, so a coyota, was a really good person. The thing is that as you're moving, coyotes are moving people through gang and drug territory. So they have to be in some kind of cooperation or communication with some pretty high level, unsavory characters. It used to be many years ago that it was just sort of like a business opportunity, that coyotes were people who just were like, okay, this is a business opportunity. You need to get from Mexico to the United States. I know the ways through the desert. Pay me and I'll take you. But as the drug violence along the border and just like the drug activity along the border with the U.S., largely as a result of the U.S. war on drugs, became such a big business and really the cartels control in patchwork all of the areas around the border, increasingly the moving of people got tangled up with the moving of drugs. So that means that this sort of idea of this older kind of generation of coyotes that were just kind of doing their thing, moving people into the United States and taking a cut, that increasingly is less and less of an option, because increasingly the cartel business and the human smuggling business are kind of working in tandem.
So it's I don't know, the coyotes are what, paying protection money or actually running stuff? I mean, how does it?
A combination, exactly. Yeah. So either paying protection money or, you know, sort of, yeah, like paying off the cartels, or in some cases in collaboration. So I had a student who told me about being in a safe house for people that was also guarded by machine guns, and there was like a huge pile of drugs in the middle of the safe house. So he was sort of, as a 16-year-old kid from, he was from El Salvador too, he was just sort of sitting there waiting to be moved along with this massive pile of drugs and being guarded by people with machine guns.
Well, we have many other questions for you about the stories that students tell at Oakland International High School, and we'll get into some of those in just a few moments. The book is called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Lauren Markham is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back to The Exchange, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're listening to a tale unfold of two young men, actually 17-year-olds, so still technically boys, from El Salvador making their way to the United States for a better life, sure, but also for removal from what was the possibility of no life at all in the midst of gang violence in their home country. Their story is told by Lauren Markham in the book The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the brothers had managed to get out of El Salvador, through Guatemala, into Mexico, reunited by near Mexico City. The crossing of the U.S. border, I can feel the desert from your description in the book. Mm-hmm. How hard a crossing was this?
Say that again?
How hard a crossing was this?
Oh, it was a really difficult crossing. You know, the crossing the border itself actually tends not to always be the most difficult part. It's really getting far enough into the United States, kind of outside of the Border Patrol, you know, crackdown zone. So the twins actually cross into the United States on a small raft with a group of other migrants, move up into Texas. There are essentially what the Border Patrol sometimes talk about as a series of three walls. So the first wall, or really fence in a lot of places, is the border wall. Again, we hear a lot about we got to build a wall. It's important to note that almost 700 miles of the wall already exist, which I think some people forget about. And I will admit, the first time, sort of vaguely knew that, but the first time in 2012 that I was at the border, I was sort of driving, trying to find my way somewhere, and all of a sudden there was this massive fence, and I was like, whoa, what is that? Because it's shocked to see this massive border wall. So again, that's the first wall. The second wall is the human wall, and that's the Border Patrol themselves. Then there's this idea of a third wall, and the Border Patrol is allowed to have immigration is allowed to have checkpoints within 100 miles of an international border. So about 70 miles north of where a lot of crossings happen. There are not that many north-south roads, and so there are a series of checkpoints, one big one in particular called Salfurrias Checkpoint, and that, because there's this massive immigration checkpoint with tons of officers and, you know, dogs, and I've had to drive through it several times, and it's kind of alarming to drive through because you're under so much scrutiny, that pushes people off of the roads, migrants off of the roads, and into the kind of open desert lands where people die of exposure, and, you know, get sick and all that. So the twins actually got, without, again, wanting to spoil too much, they actually get lost and are sort of wandering that desert land within the United States by themselves with another young migrant from Honduras.
Was there some element of wanting to be found by the Border Patrol?
It's interesting. That is the case for a number of young people where they're told by the coyotes, turn yourself in, or they just know, like, okay, I need protection and I don't want to be lost in the desert, so I'm just going to turn myself in. The twins absolutely did not want to be caught. They did not want to be caught. They wanted to make it to California with their brother, and they expected to just get jobs and live the lives of undocumented kids.
So let's come back then to the whole idea of unaccompanied minors. Are the rules different for them? I mean, is the, you know, court hearings, deportations, any of that stuff, is it different for young people, for minors, than it is for adults?
It is, yeah. So just starting with actually detention, there was a 2003 case called the Flores settlement, actually. I didn't really realize that until really late in the stage of the book that I had named the boys, they're given their pseudonym after this case. Maybe it was some subliminal move of mine, but it mostly was an accident. So that case made sure that it was a Supreme Court case, and that made sure that the unaccompanied minors would not be housed and detained in federal immigration custody along with adults. They're young people. They should be not detained with adults, which makes sense, but that wasn't law until then, until that case. So they're actually detained in what are called youth-friendly detention centers. Some of them are actually pretty nice places. Some of them are pretty horrible places. They're run by, instead of private contractors like in the adult immigration and criminal system, they're run actually by nonprofit contractors. And so they are detained for a period of time with other young people like them, and then they are released from detention into the care of a sponsor who agrees to care for their needs, to make sure they get to court and to make sure they enroll in school. So it's this interesting thing where they're released into U.S. towns and communities, but they're still in deportation proceedings and are expected to go to court to get to court. And, you know, unless they can fight their case, they will be deported.
So in this case, could their older brother, who was already in the Bay Area, be their sponsor?
He was their sponsor. And even though he was undocumented, that can be a really scary thing, right, to sign papers with the government even though you're undocumented. But it's the idea is that it's in the best interest of children not to have them detained. It also, it's very costly to detain people. So it's also a cost-saving measure that, you know, we're not going to detain these youth. They're going to go to school and be fed and clothed and housed by these sponsors, and then they'll get to their court hearings.
How was that ever discussed among the brothers before they even left El Salvador about, you know, whether if they got caught, they would contact the brother who was already in the United States without papers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they just like that they weren't even that would have meant planning, that they just weren't, had no capacity given the circumstances to plan. There sort of wasn't a plan B. The plan was get to Texas, like, you know, get into the United States. We'll figure it out from there. And their brother didn't actually know they were coming until they were already on the road.
Okay, and then he got the phone call and said, hey, here they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Come get them. There's a very clear sentence from you in this portion of the book, and it's the notion that unauthorized immigration into the United States is spiraling ever higher is a myth. What makes you sure of that statement, Lauren?
The numbers. even though there's a ton of attention on immigration right now, the fact is that unauthorized migration of young people has gone way up. So the historical average of unaccompanied minors was 6,000 to 7,000 a year. That in 2012, the fiscal year 2012, that doubled to over 12,000. Doubled again the next year to around 24,000. It was 60,000 last year. This year, because there was a dip post Trump, but it's climbing back up again. 40,000 of these young people by the end of the fiscal year, which is like tomorrow or something, will have crossed into the United States. So though that number has gone way up, as has the number of Central American families, the number of so-called illegal immigrant adults is almost a third today of what it was before the recession in 2008.
All right. So before the recession, it was many times higher.
Yes.
Okay.
So actually, net, the number of unauthorized crossings are far down. So it just kind of goes to show you that that sometimes our perception of what's happening is driven by a media frenzy in the national conversation, but the numbers just don't back up that unauthorized immigration is spiraling out of control. It's actually the opposite.
I was just thinking of the media frenzy part of that. It seems like, you know, with the whole idea that a picture tells, is better than 1,000 words. Anytime you see on TV news, like the pictures of the San Diego border crossing many years ago, of people just running through the gates there out of cars, that kind of thing, once it gets into the public discourse, seems to stay a very long time.
Yeah, it does. It does. And there's this idea, right, that's being propagated and perpetuated right now, that they're criminals, they're rapists, they're wolves in sheep's clothing, they're coming across to take our jobs, to join gangs, to bring gang violence here. Again, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of these young people and many adults as well, and that's just that is not backed up by my pretty extensive research.
So then what do you think is missing from the discussion of immigration in the United States?
Yeah. Well, I think that what happens is we really tend to focus on immigration as this thing, this dynamic that begins the minute someone steps foot across the border. Like there's this bright red line, you cross it, and then all of a sudden it's an immigration issue. And the fact is we have to look at the root causes of immigration. And so if we're not addressing the root causes, and this is true of any kind of geopolitical phenomenon, but if we're not looking at or addressing the root causes, it's sort of irrelevant what we do on this side of the border. We can build more of the wall. We can put, as they're probably going to do, we can put more Border Patrol agents on the ground. But the fact is, until Central America is stabilized, and until economic opportunity it grows in Central America and in Mexico, unauthorized crossing is going to keep happening. And even as we've built the wall and put more immigration agents on the ground, people keep coming anyway. People figure out how to go around walls, through walls. People get across the border and turn themselves in, and then the United States is responsible for detaining them and adjudicating their cases in really packed immigration courts. So, yeah, this problem, talk to anybody south of the border and many people this side of the border too, and they'll tell you that this is going to keep happening until this is an ongoing dynamic until the root causes are addressed in Central America and Mexico.
It's kind of like the old line about drugs, though. The way to get people to stop using drugs is to make reality better. But I'm sure there are people who think that it is not our job in the United States to make life better in countries outside of this one, which would seem to be the root cause. So how do you address that?
I mean, I totally understand that, I understand that perspective. But then you cannot be complaining about the immigration problem here without addressing the root cause, right? Those things go hand in hand. So if you say it's not our problem to address the root causes in Central America, fine. Well, then it is our problem to deal with the immigration issues here. And many of the people who say that's not our problem also say, why are they all coming?
Huh. So how is this best dealt with? I mean, economic policy, foreign policy, military policy?
I would probably say policy, because the crackdown, the mano dura crackdowns in El Salvador have actually only really worsened gang violence, because it's just violence dealt with violence begets more violence. But absolutely international trade policies, economic policies, investing in education and opportunities in El Salvador, and supporting El Salvadoran governments to do that themselves, working on trade policies that incentivize more things to be built and created in El Salvador, that would all go a pretty long way in addressing these things. People don't grow up wanting to join gangs and wanting to be bad guys. They grow up wanting to have a good life, and if there aren't opportunities for that, that's what pushes people into these criminal entities.
The education part in particular, why are schools funded so poorly in El Salvador? Is it just there's not enough money in the country's budget to afford much more than that?
Yeah, that's basically the problem.
Hmm.
And frankly, I work in public education here. We're not doing a good job at funding our schools either. And I have an op-ed coming out this week that talks about, you know, the importance of investing in education as kind of a public health tool and as a means of keeping criminals, gangs at bay.
We'll have to look for that op-ed. Will that be in the Chronicle?
It'll be in the New York Times, I hope.
Okay. All right. We'll keep an eye out for that one. So I want to talk about the business end of things. I mean, obviously, people make a lot of money running people out of the countries to the south of us. Are there people making a lot of money on immigration into the country?
Yes, there are, and I'm glad you asked. So, I mean, immigration is a big business in the United States, particularly the detention. I think this is all in the Trump administration has sort of shifted this, but it used to be that about 7% of, I can't remember if it's 7 or 9, I apologize, but of criminal, of detention in the criminal system. So, you know, prisons and jails were run by not by private contractors. So these are private companies that are given government contracts to run our prisons. So a small amount, relatively speaking. But Obama, before he left, sort of said we're going to do away with the private prison industry because we don't want companies having a vested interest in our criminal policy and in locking people up because, right, these companies to make they make money per head, so they have a vested interest in more people being locked up. About 60 to 70% of immigration detention is run by private contractors. I'm talking about in the adult detention system. So there are companies making a lot of money off of these detained immigrants, and have a vested interest in there being more and more detained immigrants, and therefore harsher policy. And regardless of your feelings about what immigration policy should be, I think it's a pretty sane argument that a company with a vested economic interest should not be driving any kind of domestic policies or international policies.
Now, did you say the unaccompanied minor system is run by nonprofits?
It's run by nonprofits, but a lot of them are pretty big business nonprofits. So to give you a sense, one of Southwest Key, which is one of the largest nonprofits, in a recent year, the CEO of that nonprofit made about $600,000 a year.
Not bad change.
I don't know any nonprofit CEOs or executive directors making that kind of money.
Before we go, well, let's get an idea where the Flores twins are now. How are they doing?
They're doing well, actually, all things considered. I think they're still really struggling with the impacts of trauma. They're still kind of trying to make a life here for them that kind of meets their dreams and also reckons with the realities of how hard it is to be a young immigrant living in a very, you know, they live in the Bay Area in a very expensive place. But you know, living in an administration that is not necessarily friendly to young immigrants. But all things considered, they're doing really well, and I'm really proud of them.
It's a really interesting book because we get a chance to look at the real circumstances that lead people to want to cross the border illegally in the first place. In the case of these young men, they were escaping violence in El Salvador. The book about them is called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Extensive reporting by Lauren Markham led to this book. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care.